This is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. I'm David Alan Greer, and this is In Our Time. The world is wide, and most of it is now using a computer. The kind of investment that it takes to build a computerized infrastructure, especially in a place where none has been, is discussed in this podcast, which is entitled The Theosophist's Bathroom. Originally, I had hoped that I might be able to spend 2 or maybe 3 weeks visiting the industries of Bangalore, India. With that much time, I would have been able to explore the city in detail, meet civic and industrial leaders, and really begin to appreciate how the region operated. However, when I eventually concluded that I'd be able to stay in the city for only 2 days, I carefully planned every moment of my visit. I determined where I wanted to go, who I wanted to meet, and how I would arrange for transportation from the airport. Almost immediately, my plans began to fall apart. I found my car at the air terminal, threw my bag in the back seat, pulled out my map, and told the driver that I wanted to see a group of technology businesses that were east of the downtown area. The driver took my map and carefully examined it as if it were some kind of sacred text. He rotated it in his hands and turned it over so that he could study the back. Finally, he folded the document and returned it to me and looked into my eyes. "Shopping?" he asked. "No," I responded. "I want to see software companies, computers." The driver pondered this idea for a moment. "Ah," he finally said, putting the car in gear and starting on our way. I sat in the back, taking notes and following our progress on the map. The driver made decisions with confidence. A left here, a right there. We were going through an area with modern offices that bore the trademarks of many well-known Western companies. In about 15 minutes, he stopped the car in front of a large and ornately detailed blue building. "Here," he said. "What is this?" I asked. "It isn't a software company." "Temple," he said. "It is very important." Under other circumstances, I would have been more than willing to tour the temple. Religious practice has been the pattern for so much human activity. The monasteries of medieval Europe defined the division of labor and the coordination of shared activities and the management of common resources such as land and water. Although I suspected that the temples of Bangalore might have provided me with some insight into India's commercial culture, I felt that I could not devote any of my precious time to them. "No," I said. "Software. Computers. Industrial park." "Ah," said the driver, and off we went again. As we drove away from the building, I saw a small sign over one door that suggested to me that perhaps this building might be more directly connected to the technology industry than I had believed. "The Reverend Hiram Swaminathan's Ashram and Software Academy," it read. "Java, peaceful programming. Software Enlightenment, APL. By the time we reached the large concentrations of software companies, I had learned several lessons about the area. First, like the cities of Bombay and Calcutta, Bangalore had reclaimed its pre-British name of Bengaluru. Second, the city was also the home of the Indian aerospace industry. So many local companies dealt with metalworking and machine tools. Finally, the digital technology and software firms were all connected to the high-tension electric wires that crossed and recrossed the landscape. We spent a day making an improvised tour of the various technology firms that shared the common landscape. Big firms stood next to small firms. Global companies were connected to local suppliers. Research laboratories were across the street from discount retail outlets. During a respite in our travels, we stopped at a fruit stand that stood by the entrance to a major hardware developer and watched a group of young boys and small goats play some kind of an organized game in the company's parking lot. The game seemed to be a variation on cricket, and the rules apparently favored the goats. The darkness began to spread across the sky, and I told the driver that it was time to head to my hotel. The communal air, now cool with the evening breeze, mingled with a perfume of curried spices and burning cow dung from the fires of 10,000 kitchens. The traffic slowed as we returned to the city center, choked by a parade in the honor of a local goddess. The driver, growing increasingly nervous, suddenly stopped the car next to the temple of the United Theosophical Society, opened his door, and dashed into the building. At this point, I was more intrigued than worried. I'd yet to pay him for the drive, and I owed him a substantial sum. After missing the opportunity to see Reverend Swami Nathan's Ashram and Software Institute, I was inclined to look inside the Theosophist's building. Theosophy had played an intriguing role in late Victorian India by combining the religions of Asia and Europe. "We shall unite firmly a body of men of all nations in brotherly love," wrote the founder, "and engage them in a pure altruistic work, not on a labor with selfish motives." I left the cab and headed for the building, but stopped when a loud flushing sound told me that the Theosophists controlled a public resource far more important to Bangalore taxi drivers than a body of men engaged in altruistic work. My driver returned refreshed, calm, and ready to get me to my hotel. On the whole, the software industry has given little thought to the allocation of public goods. The giant players in the field have never debated the access to the Dardanelles, for example, or fought over the coal fields of Alsace, or argued about the land along the Yangtze Valley. If anything, we often believe that computers exist outside the restrictions of shared resources and geography. Our ideals and aspirations, as recorded in the advertisement of trade journals, suggest that we conduct our business from an isolated beach in Brazil or a trout stream in the pristine wilderness. In such places, we are all masters of our fate, and we need never worry about shared resources. In fact, the software industry actually requires few common resources. Buildings can be constructed anywhere. Computing equipment can be shipped to any corner of the globe. Skilled workers, when offered adequate incentives, can move across political and even cultural boundaries. Of all the resources the software industry consumes, only electricity ties the field firmly to Earth. Until software companies can derive their energy from sunlight or spin it from the Earth's magnetic field, they will be dependent on the entities, public and private, that generate and distribute electrical power. In India, the production of electricity tested the country's ability to build a modern industrialized society. In 1966, after nearly 20 years of independence, India still had no national power grid, no unified process for creating and delivering electricity. "Dried cattle dung," wrote one engineer, "contributes as much to total energy consumption as does electricity." The story that takes India from the electrical infrastructure of 1966, the infrastructure that compares badly to burning cattle dung, to a modern infrastructure 40 years later is one of those parables for the free market. It begins with the government of the first prime minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, which distrusted capitalism and looked to the ashram and temple and the people's collective for guidance in building a modern economy. Nehru's government stressed traditional Hindu values, such as renunciation of gain and the submergence of the self for the good of all. Government ministers connected these values to the managerial techniques of the Soviet Union. "Only a revolutionary plan can solve the two related questions of land and industry," Nehru proclaimed. He also stated that he was inclined, more and more, to a communist philosophy. The communist philosophy brought technical sophistication to India. It allowed the country to build modern airplanes and to develop an atomic bomb. At the same time, it failed to build the Indian economy as Nehru had envisioned. Critics argued that the country's economic plan misidentified the economy's structure, directed funds to inefficient industries, and failed to address key problems with the country's infrastructure. "It may be pointed out that the government's discussion of Indian economic planning," wrote one critic, "is almost entirely lacking in several important issues. He claimed that it would produce less wealth than other ways of handling the economy, and that it would ensure that a large amount of investment funds would remain idle. The Indian government tried to refine and improve its methods of planning the economy, but with only limited success. "We are far from adequate optimizing models," noted an observer of the 1970s, "especially for a country as large and as complex as India. The electrical infrastructure was especially poor shape. According to critics, it was marked by an endemic power shortage, poor operational performance, and the precarious financial condition of all the state electrical boards." India began to abandon economic plannings in the 1980s, and it started reforming the electrical industry in 1991. It opened the market to private suppliers, reorganized the transmission network, allowed new firms to distribute electricity, and restructured the government's role in the market. The process was not fast, or easy, or painless. India's reforms were often compared, not always favorably, to the steps taken by Latin American countries. Yet, by the middle of the decade, the electrical infrastructure was clearly improving. By 1995, private firms were starting to generate electricity and sell it on the country's power grid. In some years, they were adding more capacity to India's electrical infrastructure than the state-run utilities. Without the reforms, the country would not have had enough power for call centers in Mumbai, radiology offices in Kolkata, or software firms in Bangalore. Even with the reforms, the electrical industry needed substantial investments to keep pace with growth. As the year 2000 approached, analysts noted that the country would need to build 10,000 megawatts of capacity per year to keep pace with the country's economic growth. Of course, the market's lesson is that projects will attract investment if the rewards are great enough. With the strength of the Indian technology industry behind it, the market delivered the capital needed to sustain the industry. Yet at the same time, some investors began using those same markets to circumvent the problems of the Indian electrical infrastructure. They built economic ashrams, private industrial parks with private roads, private buildings, private housing, and finally, private sources of clean, uninterrupted electricity. Private electricity, like the private resources of a monastery or an ashram, is in the hands of like-minded organizations that have separated themselves from the world. If you believe the advertisements, the tenants of the Indian industrial parks are spiritually inclined businesses that would not misuse the common resources. In these parks, companies are motivated by pride of ownership. Customers come for a delightful experience, and employees receive the blessings of fulfilled aspirations. It might not be peaceful programming and APL, but it does seem to be a good place to get away from the problems of the world's infrastructure and to do a little business. On my second day in Bangalore, I was awakened by the sound of a ringing telephone. "Your driver is here," said the voice on the other end of the line. It seemed awfully early for me to begin the day's work, but I pulled myself from bed, quickly dressed, and headed downstairs. At the doorman's suggestion, I had hired a hotel driver to get me to my appointments. "Our staff is more knowledgeable than the local taxi drivers," he said. "They won't get lost." Yet, as the day progressed, my new guide seemed little better than the previous day's driver. He didn't seem able to read a map and repeatedly had to stop and ask directions. On one leg of the journey, we not once but twice passed the Reverend Hiram Swami Nathan's ashram, although we received neither peace in programming nor enlightenment in software. In the middle of the day, when we were out on Mysore Road, I had to flag a policeman and ask his guidance. We returned to the hotel in darkness after the obligatory stop at the Theosophist's bathroom. When I entered the lobby, the doorman ran up to me and said, "You didn't come down for your car this morning." For a moment, I didn't know what to say. "Yes, I did," I stated. "The driver is just leaving the hotel." The doorman looked through a window and said, "That's not a hotel car. That's a private cab." "What do you mean?" I asked. "That was not the driver we hired for you." Needless to say, this last remark led to a lengthy discussion with the doorman. In this discussion, each of us had a different goal. I wanted to learn how the rogue driver had called my room, and the doorman wanted to learn how I was going to reimburse the hotel for the car I had never used. As we were in the context of a market economy, I, as customer, had more power than he, as supplier. The doorman canceled the debt eventually and gave me a reasonable explanation for the day's events. He said that the driver had probably been in the lobby the day before and had heard me make arrangements for the car, and had decided to capture my business before the hotel driver arrived. A clever exploitation of a free market, I suppose, but a market that I would have preferred to avoid. You've been listening to In Our Time. This podcast was based on an essay published in the June 2008 issue of Computer, which is a publication of the Computer Society. More about Computer and the Computer Society can be found at www.computer.org. To find the information about Computer, click on the Technical Magazines link under Publications. Other Computer Society podcasts can be found at www.computer.org/podcasts. If you have any comments, we would love to hear them. You can send them to podcasts@computer.org. The music for this podcast came from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. You can find it at music.podshow.com. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.